From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how the remarkable work of Ear Hustle podcast producers Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods has changed since Woods was released from prison. Then a human trafficking survivor explains why she started speaking about her experiences.
I thought this was crazy that people don't know this, and so I wanted to share my story to show people that it's not just people in other countries or people being locked away in a basement here. You know, it can look like kids from the suburbs, too.
And astronomy contributor Gene Creighton explains why it took humans so long to figure out that stars moved.
Really, if you think about it, the stars look fixed. I mean, yes, they move all in unison, but stars seem to be in the same place with respect to other stars over year and year and year.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Visual artist Nigel Poor has spent years offering us a glimpse of life behind bars. Poor is not herself incarcerated, but she's worked with people inside California's San Quentin prison to tell the stories of everyday life. Among the ways she's done that is through curating a remarkable group of large format photographs taken over years by prison staff. But Poor has also co-produced and hosted a podcast called Ear Hustle, along with Erlon Woods, who was sentenced to 31 years to life for second-degree attempted armed robbery. Woods' sentence was commuted in 2018, and he's now a free man and a full-time producer for Ear Hustle, although his stories have obviously changed since leaving prison. Woods and Nigel Poor spoke with Lake Effect producer Joy Powers about their work together, and Woods talked about what it was like to finally leave prison after two decades behind bars.
It was almost like the 21 years never happened. I would say it wasn't like a major shock. It was just like being back to something that was familiar. It was only a couple of things that surprised me, like not seeing currency, like real live tender green backs for like 2 days. Everybody was using cards and phones to pay for everything, so that was kind of different. And I always say that the other difference was in prison, you don't see homelessness. In Oakland, you see it everywhere. So that was a shock. But I went from suspended animation to back on the ground. So it was cool.
You spent so much of your time the last 3 years really analyzing what life is like inside of prison. How much did you prepare for and talk about what life would be like outside of prison? And this is really a question for both of you. How much did that topic come up for you?
Well, I mean, most people in prison fantasize about being outside of the prison. So, you know, my mind was already out there in the streets. But we used to talk about, like, when we get out, we're going to cover reentry or something. You know, we're going to just add a different component to Ear Hustle. And I think that's what we used to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't talk so much about what his life was going to be like. What we talked about, what could happen with Ear Hustle, was the big conversation, and how it would be great when we were both outside to be able to do things together and start going to other prisons, traveling together, do things like this together. Obviously, when Erlon was inside, I was the one that had to represent everything on the outside. That came with a lot of stress. And so it's just great that now we can do it together as regular professional colleagues would. So that's what we talked. I mean, that is really where our conversation was, and what it would be like to have, you know, Erlon come on as a full-time outside producer as opposed to a full-time inside producer.
And that's a question I had as, you know, a listener. Mm-hmm. What's going to change?
Well, we're still figuring that out, but we did a job search inside the prison. I'm laughing because Erlon likes to call it a talent contest. We had a job search inside the prison where we actually put an ad out, and we had about 30 guys apply for the position. We did two rounds of interviews, and we got it down to three people, and then we had them come and do narration with me, do a story pitch. So we ended up hiring, you know, in quotes hire, because we can't pay guys. We hired a guy named, I'm not sure if we're revealing who it is yet. So we hired a new guy who is going to do co-hosting with me on the inside, and we'll continue to do stories on the outside. And then the big change is Erlon will be doing stories about reentry on the outside, and we'll still be co-hosting that. And we're just figuring out how that's going to flow. And then eventually, I don't know if it will be season 4 or season 5, Erlon and I hopefully will start traveling to other prisons to do stories about what it's like at a level 3, level 4, the different things. Because San Quentin is a very specific prison, and not all prisons are like that.
I was about to say, there's so many different kinds of prisons in this country, which, you know, outside of something like your podcast, we don't really make that distinction between each kind of prison. Cop shows or, you know, the kinds of cultural ways that we talk about prison in the maybe oblique sense, we often don't make a distinction, but there is a big distinction.
Huge distinction. I think, Erlon should probably talk to this. He lived it. I observed it, but in my mind, there's a huge difference.
In the structure of prison, it's done by different levels. Like level 1 means you're like the person that can leave the institution and go work out in society, or are you in a real, that's the lowest custody you would be in. Level 2 is like a little bit higher than that. You probably can't go outside the prison, but it's a lower custody. Most of the times you've been incarcerated for a long time and your points didn't drop. Level 3 is more of a higher custody, and level 4 is like maximum custody. So they look at level 4 as like for people that has a lot of points, whether it's for write-ups or just they have a certain amount of time where they can't drop their points. San Quentin is like one part of it is a level 5, which is death row. And then the rest of it is level 2. And there's technically no level 5, but if there was, death row would be level 5.
And I think what you were saying is, and I think when the general public thinks about prison, what they're thinking about is a level 4 maximum security prison, because that's what, you know, most TV, that's what most movies, that's what most bad journalism hypes on, is what a level 4 prison is like. And your hustle is doing stories about life at a level 2 prison. And so there's a lot more freedom there, there's a lot more programming there. So you asked about change, one of the things is to tell stories about life at a level 4. So we don't want Ear Hustle to give people the impression that all prisons are like San Quentin, because they're not. We also don't want everyone to think every prison's like a level 4.
Right.
So we
right.
just I think we have a responsibility now that you're out right. to tell those different kinds of stories.
Indeed, and that's what we look to do, is because, again, level 4s are different. You know, I think they're changing a little bit as far as, you know, the programs and the groups, but sometimes it's a violent place. You know, sometimes people want a program, but they can't based on the politics or their surrounding. You know, so we would love to go tell stories on level 4, because they're going to be a lot different.
Very different. You know what else I was thinking? We have to get outside of California, because let's say if we came to prisons in Wisconsin,
right.
They're probably pretty different.
Probably
so,
very different.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I was about to say, you know, Milwaukee has, I believe, the highest rate of Black incarceration in the nation, and the highest Black-white disparity in terms of incarceration rates. Is that something that you would want to dig into with prisons in the Milwaukee area in Wisconsin?
Well, you answer
no, first. I would just say that if I walked into prison and I seen 200 Black dudes to 2 white dudes, I'd be like, hey, this looks a little different here. Let me go ask the white dudes how they coping in this type of environment.
But you bring up a good question. We don't do stories about policy. We do narratives about everyday life. So yes, that is a story we'd want to do, but we'd want to think about how can we do that story through, you know, a first-person narrative that isn't talking about numbers and facts. Because I found personally when I listen to something, what I'm moved by is a story. I'm not moved by facts. I'm not moved by policy talk and numbers. I find that really boring. Yes, I want facts, but I want to hear someone's personal account of what's that experience like. So I think that's what we would do, and in a roundabout way, get to that disparity.
What policy looks like in people.
Yes. I guess you could say it that way. Yeah, yeah. But if we just get on, you know, if we just tell a story that a legislature, someone who's working in the legislature could tell, that's going to put me to sleep. And I imagine if it puts me to sleep, it's going to put a lot of listeners to sleep. So we have to walk the line of being entertaining and having a call to action. I think that's the line we're always walking, because we want people to, like, they can't wait to hear that, how is this story going to end? So we have a responsibility to think like artists and creative people, and then we also have the dual responsibility of wanting people to think in a different way about incarceration and get things to change. In a sort
what
of
was that? What do we call it? Edutainment?
Edutainment.
Something like that. Educate the public and at the same time entertain them in a way where, you know, the stories they hear are some stories that they're like, damn, that's just like me.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yes. I'm in that same circumstance, but I just took a different choice or a different route in my life.
Showing the commonalities.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do.
So you were just talking about the audience kind of on the outside looking in, but what I found so fascinating about your podcast is it's not just the outside looking in, it's also the inside looking around, I guess.
Well, inside it's interesting too. Tell her what our original idea was for the podcast.
So our original idea was to just air Ear Hustle inside of San Quentin. It wasn't to be for the larger consumption. We would have probably hoped for that, but we never even thought of that. Like, we was, and I think Nigel's dream was just to air it in all the prisons in California.
Yeah.
So at the time we were putting our first episode together, Nigel just walked in with a brochure that had Radiotopia's PodQuest and was like, what do y'all think about this? He was like, all right, that's cool. So that is why we are sitting here right now having this interview.
That's right, yeah. So, yeah, on a lark, we got permission from the prison to apply for this contest that Radiotopia, which is part of PRX, was
which they didn't think we were going to win because we'd never done a podcast before.
No. And we got permission from Lieutenant Robinson, who's a voice that you hear in every podcast. People have grown to love him. He gets recognized in public, too.
Oh, that's what's up.
Yeah. Or his voice. People recognize his voice. So he gave us permission to submit. And then
we submitted a 1 minute and 40, no, 1 minute and 56 second pitch.
Yeah, a pitch, yeah.
Of what our show would be like. And out of 1,536 other entries.
From how many countries?
53 different countries.
Yep.
We won. Well, it was a top 10, then a top 4, then we won a top 4. Which gave us the platform of Radiotopia and PRX.
Yes.
And which put us around the world immediately.
The funny thing was, well, there are many odd things, but then when we won, Lieutenant Robinson said that he had said yes because he never thought we would win. And so when we won, all of a sudden, Erlon and I were like, we got to learn how to make a podcast.
Yeah.
And Lieutenant Robinson was like, ooh, now I got to figure out, you know, how is this actually going to work?
Right.
How are we going to do this and okay it? Because at that point, we were then obligated that stories had to go out. You know, we couldn't, we weren't picked up by Radiotopia to do stories that would just air inside the prison. It was to air outside.
We didn't know nothing about the podcast world. Did you know, since Nigel listened to radio.
You didn't know what a podcast was.
I didn't know what a podcast was. No, I don't think nobody knew what a podcast was.
Well, you mean nobody?
Somebody broke it down to me that it's a iPod and broadcast.
Oh, yeah.
And they put together a podcast. We didn't know what it was. So, you know, we was like, you know, what is a successful, you know, downloads, you know? And I think they told us like maybe 50,000.
20,000.
Was it 20,000 per episode or for the season?
I think 20,000 per episode is very successful.
And I was like, nah, we gonna do like a million. And they was like, you know, that's like, you know, the big leagues, you know, a million. And in our first month, we did 1.5 million downloads.
Yeah.
So they was like, oh, he was clairvoyant.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But the other thing that you were not clairvoyant about was I brought in some podcasts for them, for the guys to listen to, so they get an idea.
So
I got permission to bring in Snap Judgment for them to listen to. And after we listened, I think your comment was, oh, that's easy.
Oh, that's easy. that's hella easy. And nah. The hard part is making it sound easy.
Exactly. That's the challenge. That's how do you make it sound effortless?
That's the hard part, and I realized that later. Like, oh, it wasn't just a conversation. It was like hours of editing, hours of tape.
Well, you also bring up a point that is super important to me, is that this is, when we started the project, one of the ideas was that this would be an inside and outside collaboration and work as evidence to other people that those who are incarcerated and those who are not can work together as professional colleagues, and that there should be more projects that do that as a way to bridge the gap or make that wall less hard to get over. And so it is important to point out that a lot of the work is done inside the prison, but we do actually, I mean, I obviously don't, I'm not incarcerated, but we do have a team of people now on the outside that help, and a solid, hardworking team inside. So I love how collaborative this project is, and that's new for me too, as like an artist who's worked by herself in a studio for like 25 years, to all of a sudden do a collaboration and to know that it can't happen unless Erlan and I and the other people are working together is a wonderful feeling. To really find a strong creative partner is great. And I think we make each other better. I mean, I couldn't do it without you, and I don't think you could do it without me. But I'll let you say that.
No, I second what she said. I let her say it. You said it good. It came out good. And then, like I said, we also have a sound design team that Pat Mesiti Miller lead, where we have Antoine William and David Jossie and a few other guys inside the prison that contributes dope-ass music.
Can you say that word on public radio?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that one you can't say.
Bleep, yeah.
I mean, there's so much in front of you right now. You know, there's season 4, of course, which is kind of the immediate future, but then, you know, potentially season 5, season 6, season...
Oh, yeah.
30.
Yeah.
Season 30. What are you guys looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to the world hearing the new co-hosts, one of the new co-hosts. His name is blank, blank, blank. And he or she, should I say that?
Oh, yeah.
He or she. No, but I'm looking forward to how he moved the Inside podcast to a different space and, you know, a different personality. He's hilarious. That's what I'm looking forward to. I want to see him do his thing. Because we tease him, and he played practical jokes on me all the way. And even when I was in R&R, he played a practical joke on me, which is receiving and release. I was on my way getting out, and they sent me a box, a dress-out box that was like this big, and I'm looking at it like, all my stuff can't be in that little box, but I'm not thinking nothing. And I reach in, and it's something orange. I'm like, okay, I got an orange. I pull it out. It's CDCR uniform, like a reception uniform. I'm like, okay, cool. They got me. Wasn't my dress-outs.
One of the things I'm looking forward to, and I spoke on this earlier, is that Erlan and I being able to travel together, to be able to do more public presentations together, give more talks, and think about other ways that Your Hustle can exist beyond a podcast. I don't know what that is, but thinking about what are the possibilities, because we've been fortunate enough to get a big following and to have a lot of opportunities come our way that I hope we can take advantage of and push us creatively and emotionally. And, you know, I don't know how this can translate to things beyond a podcast, but I'm curious about that.
You don't see the TV series?
I'm trying to be discreet.
Thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and joining us here in Milwaukee.
Yes, we're excited to be here.
Appreciate it. I'm waiting on the snow to come down.
Nigel Poor is a visual artist based in California's Bay Area and co-producer of the Ear Hustle podcast. Erlan Woods is also a producer of Ear Hustle. He was released in 2018 from San Quentin Prison after serving more than 2 decades for second-degree attempted armed robbery. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers while they were in town to speak to an audience at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We'll take a short break and then talk to a woman about her life growing up going to school by day while being trapped in sex trafficking at night. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The International Labor Organization says there are more than 40 million victims of human trafficking around the world. The group says a quarter are children and three-quarters are women and girls. It's a multi-billion dollar industry that enriches the perpetrators through the sexual slavery of their victims. Criminals often prey on vulnerable groups such as immigrants or people living in poverty. But our next guest is proof that human trafficking occurs throughout all communities, and it's often hidden in plain sight. Teresa Flores was 15 and living in an upper-middle-class neighborhood of Detroit, Michigan, with her parents and brothers. Her book, The Slave Across the Street, describes how she lived a double life, going to school by day but trapped in sex trafficking at night. Today, Flores works to expose trafficking and to help its victims. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone to talk about her story.
I mean, every story is different, but every story has common themes that run through it. Mine was being just a, you know, vulnerable 15-year-old, but from a upper middle class suburb with two parents. And so you wouldn't imagine that I would be vulnerable to being trafficked. And it's just kind of not what we, in our framework of what we think of as human trafficking in the United States. But I was, because my parents were busy. They weren't at home a lot, weren't really noticing any changes. And I was targeted by a group, and one of the members of this group, or several of them, went to my high school and was groomed by them, made to kind of, you know, fall in love with one of the boys. And he asked me if I wanted to ride home from school one day, and I thought he was going to take me home. But he took me to his home and ended up drugging and raping me. And after that, they had photos which they used to blackmail me with.
And then you were caught in this vicious cycle of going to school during the day, still trying to keep up with your duties as a student, as a daughter, helping with a family, and yet at night being trapped in this awful cycle. How did that affect you, first off, as a teenager, not even mentally, emotionally fully developed, but how did you find that that challenged you emotionally over the long term?
Well, it takes a lifetime to heal from something like that. It's not something that goes away. I mean, it will affect every survivor for the rest of her life. So, I mean, it affects, you know, you get PTSD from it, you get depression from it. Many end up with physical problems as well, because it is a very violent situation over and over again.
Your book that you wrote, it's called The Slave Across the Street, The True Story of How an American Teen Survived the World of Human Trafficking. But before this even came out, you first told someone in college, an old boyfriend of yours, what happened to you. But then you mentioned it was nearly 20 years before you could even tell your whole story again. So what inspired you to write this book, and then your role now as a speaker, to go out in public and talk about your experience to all these groups of people?
Yeah. It was about 12 years ago when I went to a conference on human trafficking and realized that's what was called what had happened to me. And I never knew that. And at the time, we did not have a law against it in Ohio. And I had teenage daughters. And I thought, this is crazy that people don't know this. And so I wanted to share my story to show people that it's not just people in other countries or people being locked away in the basement here. You know, it can look like kids from the suburb too. So that's really what motivated me to do it. And over the course of the last 12 years, I've met just woman after woman after woman who say me too. And it's just shocking that we've stayed in silence this whole time. And I think that's where we really need to do a better job raising awareness that this happens in every zip code.
How do survivors' stories often get rejected from listeners, and how has that impacted you personally?
I don't think that they get rejected. I think that people just don't hear them very often. Or they think, well, she was just a prostitute. She wanted to do this. She was just for drugs. But, you know, the fact is that people are buying her, that these men are purchasing young girls for sex, vulnerable women. And that's where that's got to stop, is we need to go after the demand for this. Because there's always going to be vulnerable women and girls out there. But if we can tighten up the demand and say, you know, in our country, you just can't buy another person. And we're going to go after you if you try to do that. I think that's what it's going to take to change this.
Why do you think it's so hard for Americans to comprehend the topic of sex trafficking? And how do you find people respond to the word slavery? Because I don't think people would connect those two.
Yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself having been a slave. I remember seeing my picture on the news one night and it said, former child sex slave. I'm like, really? I just never, even a prostitute. Like, I never have considered myself that I was a prostitute. I was prostituted. You know, men bought me for sex, but I didn't benefit out of that. I didn't get anything out of that. So I think that that's a big reason why America has a hard time grasping this, because of those words and the mindset that we've had all these years on what is prostitution, what is human trafficking. Human trafficking, that happens somewhere else, not here. You know, so really through educating people on what this looks like and the spans of it is what we need to do. If they think of human trafficking or slavery in the United States, you know, they might have that vision of a girl being chained to a, you know, a bed in a basement. And that generally doesn't happen. So it's definitely more covert than that.
What do you want to make sure people know about how and why people can stay trapped in trafficking and how it's not so easy to simply escape? Your book says that people often ask questions after you make a presentation and they often go to logistics or things that, you know, why didn't you do this per se and not talking about any of the other circumstances?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're very quick to, people can be very quick to blame the victim. You know, well, you should have told your parents or why didn't you tell the police? And you got to remember, you know, I was 15, I was 16, and you're being blackmailed. You're told your family's going to be killed. So you do what it takes to defend your family. And we really need to do a better job asking those questions. Well, whatever happened to those guys? Like, why didn't they get in trouble? And, you know, who were these men that bought you, you know, at 1 a.m. in some house and knew you were 15? So those are the questions that we need to start asking.
There's a quote in your book that says, quote, survivors seem to be the only people we can tell who will accept the entire story without judgment. We suffer from a deep sense of unworthiness and post-traumatic stress. So I'm curious, over the years and since you decided to share your story, what kind of stories have you heard from other women? And how do you all share your stories of becoming proactive about taking that next step in your self-care to really not just store these memories away, but face them and heal from them?
Right. Well, it's been a really cool thing to see this movement of survivors bonding together and then even survivors rising up to become leaders in this. So I am quick to tell survivors that not everybody has to write their a book or has to be on a stage and tell their story. I mean, even just trying to be the best mom after something like that happened is a win. We connect through conferences at the Soap Project that I run. We have had 4 survivor retreats, and we ask people to apply to come to our retreat because survivors aren't very good about self-care. You know, we really want to take care of others, and a lot of them financially are not able to even, you know, go get a pedicure. And they don't know what good touch is. And, you know, a massage is a really hard thing to do when you've been used. So those are some of the things that we teach them, like it's okay to do something good for yourself and you deserve it. You're worth this. And so our retreats are something that's just really cool. We spend a whole weekend with survivors. We fly them to us for free. And we have sessions on worthiness and identity and boundaries and how to be a good mom. And then we just have fun together because it is like most other people don't have any idea what we went through. And it is something that we don't even have to say it to one another because we all know, even if our stories are different.
And I imagine that fulfills you in a different way compared to going out to public events and doing educational work versus connecting with survivors.
Yeah, it's all of it. You know, it's full circle from sharing my story on stage and educating people, and they're like, oh my gosh, to getting people to help me label bars of soap with the hotline number and going out and looking for missing kids that are being trafficked, to pouring into survivors. It's all needed. As we're uncovering this rock of trafficking and what it looks like here, we're finding so many survivors and so many victims out there. And we're not really getting that many services. So it's still lacking in healthcare, knowing about this, free counseling for survivors, job skills, because a lot of times you can't work a 9-to-5, you know, it's just not in your DNA anymore. So it takes all of that.
Well, and you touch upon the services, and part of your work today is meeting with emergency and medical personnel to educate them on what to look for and how to help a trafficking victim. So what are the signs that you teach them? Because often those people are the first point of contact, but perhaps they just get sent back into the same situation.
Yeah, for first responders, you know, I always tell them what might look like a stabbing or an overdose should totally be something different. It could be somebody that is reaching out for help, that somebody did this to her. Some of the signs are, you know, a younger girl that is hanging around a motel, maybe in her pajamas, or checking in on a school day during the day with an older man or even an older woman. So there's so many signs that it'd be hard to go over all of them. But if you get a gut instinct that something just doesn't seem right, it's probably not right. And we just ask people to say something. And who cares if you're wrong? Because you might just have saved that girl's life being right.
What do you think, in addition, needs to be taught to educators and staff in schools? Because, for example, with your trafficking experience, you were going to school during the day and entrapped in sex trafficking at night. And you mentioned how security guards, teachers looked the other way as these boys were clearly intimidating you, whether they knew it was concerning that or not. There was clearly a problem. So what should be done? Because that's a large part of kids' day is with these people.
Yeah. And we still are not really getting out to the teachers and the counselors and school nurses, and even talking to the kids, because they see things. They know what's going on in school. But, you know, is the kids' grades dropping tremendously? Are they missing a lot of school? Are they constantly in the nurse's office? Is her demeanor changing? Is her dress changing? And you've got these older guys that are hanging around her. Maybe she's starting to use drugs. That's hard, because it could look like, oh, this kid's just going through a hard time right now. So it is difficult to say, oh, this for sure is trafficking. But you just have to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and then talk to her, reach out to her, say, hey, you know, I see something going on here. Can I help you?
Back in your experience, that could have been one major step that could have helped you escape that situation. And living through that period of your life by shutting down emotionally, and the resources you were trying to access, you mentioned some therapists weren't quite helpful or didn't know how to tackle that subject. How have you seen resources grow today compared to when you were ready to reach out to people after your experience?
Oh, wow. You know, I do have to admit it's still really lacking in society, but it has gotten better. You know, counselors are getting trained, like trauma training, and they're getting trained in PTSD. There's a wonderful place here in Columbus that does crime and trauma healing, and it's free for counselors, survivors of any kind of crime. So we really need to get better at having places like that available and counselors trained on it. But I do a lot of trainings for ER doctors and nurses, and they're doing a much better job recognizing the signs and then coming up with procedures for their facility on what is it that I can do as a whole, as a hospital, if we see this. So that's the area, the way that we're kind of going into things now.
Part of the equation at times when busting sex trafficking rings or helping survivors is, of course, arresting the offenders and busting these circles. And I'm curious, have you ever looked back into the group in Detroit to pursue any action against them or help any other people that may have been victimized by the same group of people?
Well, I have turned over their names to the Attorney General's office. I did that many years ago. But the statute of limitations is up for me. There was no law against human trafficking back then. Any kind of law like for rape or, you know, even kidnapping, I think, is probably over. I just, like, this is what my justice looks like, is by educating others, by sharing my story, by pouring into survivors now. And so that's how I've determined I will give back. But I'm even more into going after just the purchaser, because I think that if we can stop the purchaser, then we can stop the supply and demand.
Part of that would also, I imagine, be a big cultural shift in how women are viewed in society. So when men are coming to your event or have questions, how are you, you know, trying to shift their perspective on things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just even by simply sharing my story, that's starting to plant a seed into them. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, this is wrong. We shouldn't be doing this. And I encourage them to talk to other men. We have some new T-shirts that we are encouraging men to wear, and they say, real men don't buy sex. And if we just started there with that conversation, we could actually change this whole issue.
Right. And, you know, just one example of this once in a while being in the public spotlight is often around the Super Bowl. Outside of these events that are in the news for a bit, how do we keep the attention on this issue when it's affecting so many people in every city?
Yeah, well, media has to get better on that. This is the second leading crime in the United States. Why is it that we're not hearing this every single day on the news? We hear about drug trafficking and border problems and things like that. But if this is the second leading crime right here, then it should be on the nightly news. It should be in the newspaper every day. So I think that media could really help with that a lot.
In your book, you have, quote, "Naively, I still believe people were good. I didn't want to stop believing that, though it was not a belief that was benefiting me." So today, as you've lived your adult life as a parent, as a social worker, and a public speaker, you know, how has your perspective on people changed, or has it stayed the same?
I still believe good in people. I just, I guess that's in my DNA, but I'm not naive anymore. I guess that's the difference. And I'm driven. I have a passion, a mission to change this. So, that's kind of the way it is now.
And how do you continue your self-care today when you go in front of audiences and share one of the darkest periods of your life time and time again?
Well, I did that yesterday to about 150 people. I shared my story, and then I went back to the airport and had a pedicure and a glass of wine. So that's my self-care. And then just being around my family, that helps. I do get massages every month, so I do practice what I preach.
Well, Teresa Flores, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to share your story with me today and, of course, for the work that you continue to do.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for getting this message out there.
Teresa Flores is a sex trafficking survivor, an advocate, founder of Save Our Adolescents from Prostitution, and the author of The Slave Across the Street, the true story of how an American teen survived the world of human trafficking. We'll take another break, and then Gene Creighton explains why it took humans so long to figure out that stars moved. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. If you look up at the night sky, you can probably locate the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, and maybe if you're a real astrophile, you can point out Delphinus or Virgo. But it's not obvious to most stargazers that the stars move. Astronomer and Lake Effect contributor Gene Creighton joins us in the studio now to discuss how we discovered that they do indeed move. As you swept into the room, I started thinking about motion. And while you and I are not stars in that sense, stars move, right?
They do.
And how did we ever figure out that they did, that it wasn't just us?
Well, that's an excellent question. It turns out that it took us a while to figure that out because, really, if you think about it, the stars look fixed. I mean, yes, they move all in unison, but stars seem to be in the same place with respect to other stars over year and year and year. So how did we discover this, you'll say? Here is how we figured this out. There are not many stars that get occulted, is the term, by the moon. That means the moon will pass over them. Now, as you, I'm sure you can visualize this, clearly, this happens for many stars. I mean, the moon goes through the whole, you know, makes a full circle around the Earth every year. But it doesn't happen to hit many bright stars. So, in ancient Greece, people noticed that when the moon goes in front of certain stars, they disappear immediately, abruptly. It's not a gradual thing because the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. And if it's in fact a phase of the moon where it's the dark side that's cutting off the star, it is so mysterious because a star is there, a bright star, first magnitude, and then it's gone. And the moon passes by, and then it comes back.
Let me interrupt.
Oh, absolutely.
So how did we just not think, well, that's the moon moving?
Oh, we did think that.
Okay.
We understood. The moon, somebody's moving.
Yeah.
But that's cool. That's, okay. That was under our, we had that in our grasp. That was fine. But that helped us get very detailed positions of where these stars were. So about 1,000 years later, actually, I'm looking at my notes here. So these observations were from 509 AD in Athens, where this had happened to Aldebaran. This is the bright reddish star in Taurus. I'll throw in a little bit of trivia here. Aldebaran comes from an Arabic word for follower, because if you're sitting there and looking at the stars as time goes on through the night, you'll see the seven sisters, or otherwise known as the Pleiades, move, and Aldebaran seems to be following them. So this had happened several times in 509. That made an impression. It was recorded. There we had it. So Edmund Halley of the Comets fame in 1718 looked at the records and said, wait a second. I'm looking at the position of Sirius. I'm looking at the position of Arcturus, another bright spring star, and Aldebaran, and they're off by minutes of arc from where they are now. This he found confusing. A minute of arc is not a usual kitchen kind of unit. So let's just remind ourselves that there are 360 degrees in one circle. Each of those degrees is 60 arc minutes. So one part in 60 of a degree, these stars were off. Now you might think, well, that's not very much, but it was enough to make him scratch his head and do some calculations and realize, oh, there is proper motion. That's the term for it. So proper motion tells us that stars move perpendicular to the line of sight. So if you look at a star long enough, I mean, this is a small effect, right? You're not going to be able with the naked eye easily to see something that's a few arc minutes. But over time, you will see something like a quarter the size of the moon, which is something you will notice if you had some reference points, right?
Yep.
So in 1718, we discovered that stars do move in an absolute sense. And we also realized that over time, long periods of time, 10,000 years or so, the patterns that we see as constellations are going to be altered because those stars are physically moving in space. And if you wait for, let's say, 100,000 years, the Big Dipper is going to be quite unrecognizable.
What we see today.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was at a time, were we sure that we circled the sun at that point?
In 1700s, yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. We were confident on that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we knew that, but we somehow thought that the heavens were fixed, as it were.
Well, they certainly looked so, mm-hmm. right? So the stars seem to be, if you imagine it as a dome, they seem to be, of course, they move from day to day through the day, and you see different stars through the year. We knew that. But we thought that the relative positions of each star with respect to its neighbors is the same.
Right, which is pinned in place.
Pinned in place, if you will. But they're not moving.
Mm-hmm.
Which in some ways seems a little odd now. How could that possibly be? But that was consistent with many years of observation. So it took a detailed observation of something really bright that we really have nailed to say, oh, these stars are actually moving in the sky. And if you, as I said, if you had long enough to really take those observations, you would see the patterns, the relative positions of stars moving.
Well, and of course, in reverse, if for somehow we got to Arcturus, say, and looked back at Earth, we'd be moving. Earth would be moving too, right?
Well,
the whole,
yes.
The whole
so
system?
They wouldn't, of course, be able to see the Earth probably specifically,
no.
But they'd see the sun.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, the sun would be moving. Yeah,
right.
Sure. So I thought that what a cool idea. And I love the idea that because the moon has no atmosphere, this is one of the most instantaneous effects you can see in the sky. There are other things. Most planets, for example, have an atmosphere. So that dimming is going to be more gradual.
And you wouldn't necessarily pick it up.
And you wouldn't pick it up,
right,
necessarily. So this is my little special treat that I was looking at the history of Aldebaran. I'm learning more about Arabian contributions to astronomy. And Aldebaran is from the Arabic. And I realized that Aldebaran has this cool property that because it's a first magnitude star, it has that effect. And first magnitude, that's also an interesting historical fact. All the stars, Hipparchus was the astronomer who did this, I think it was in the first century AD, said, look at all these stars. They're not all the same brightness, obviously. He was able to catalog about 6,000 stars, and he put them in six bins. The first magnitude star was the brightest, and he got down to the sixth magnitude, which was barely visible with the naked eye. And he put these stars in bins, and the idea was to be able to classify them by their apparent brightness, how bright they seem to be. This isn't connected to how bright they really are, because that depends also on their distance. He was able then to classify, and Aldebaran is in that first class of stars, the really bright ones. So anyway, that's my playful astronomical story for today.
Springtime.
Yes.
We're dancing. The stars are dancing in the spring. It's all about motion, right?
That's right.
Well, let's hope that the next time we talk, it will be even warmer, Jean, and we'll have other stories of celestial motion.
Yes.
All right.
I look forward to it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the campus of UW-Milwaukee, and she is our regular astronomy contributor. Well, if you get tired of watching the stars, you can always turn to your TV, like Lake Effect essayist Mel Miskimmon, who maybe spent just a little too much time glued to the TV recently.
I approached the information kiosk in the middle of the bookstore with a combination of apprehension and embarrassment, as if I was going to ask for the sexually explicit section, which in a way I was, kind of. Do you have those Outlander books? The girl cursed the slowness of her internet connection, admitted, yes, she had them, and told me to follow her. She led me past the young adult section, past pets, past gardening. You know, there's a TV show, she said. Yeah, I know. I started watching, and I had to stop. Why? She said. I've heard it's pretty good. Yeah, it's good. A little too good. Let's just say I had a little break with reality. I told her that my husband had been out of town on business, and I was in a mood for a good binge-worthy series. My tastes usually default to quirky comedies, but the thumbnail of a man in a kilt, windswept hair, I thought, I'll give it a go. Yeah, I haven't been the same since. Twinges, tingles, and flutters that had been dormant, that I thought had left the building along with my collagen, had been awakened from a deep slumber thanks to the kilted hunk of burning Scott with a broadsword and a broad smile. I binged. It wasn't pretty. I went to bed thinking about the possibility of time travel. The books were on the lower shelf. She sat on the floor to find the right copy. I knelt. Perhaps that's why I felt like I could confess to her. I used to make fun of people who read romance novels, I said, or who were into Game of Thrones. But now, I have to reevaluate my whole worldview. And that's a bad thing, she said. She slipped the receipt inside the book and wished me happy reading. I distinctly remember, back in high school, my English teacher, Miss Jellin, gave the class an assignment to read a 500-page book in a week. I thought, what fresh hell? Different story now. I don't eat. I don't sleep. It's all I can do to remember to let the dog out. My husband comes home, and I'm knee-deep in Heather, craving whiskey because, in the book, they're always drinking whiskey. I read while wrapped in a plaid blanket because the characters are frequently cold and damp, and it's the closest thing I have to a kilt. I want to learn Gaelic, find out if I carry the gene for red hair. I haven't been on Facebook in weeks. I haven't checked the news headlines on my phone. I can't find the time to text people. I had been looking forward to the final season of Veep, but I haven't seen an episode yet. Despite the lack of indoor plumbing and antibiotics, or the threats of uprisings, or the possibility of being burned at the stake for witchcraft, 18th century Scotland is more appealing than 21st century America.
Lake Effect essayist Mel Miskimmin's work has appeared in numerous national and local publications. The Milwaukee writer is also the author of two books, Cop's Kid and Sit, Stay, Heal. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again soon for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.